Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So it's a pleasure to have everyone here joining us for Joseph Goldstein's talk here. Just before heading over to that, let's say that this will be available for 48 hours on the portal. And then if you do want, you can also upgrade the package. But Joseph Goldstein, co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, interviewed by Mark Walsh here. So looking forward to getting this rocking and rolling. Do let me know if you need any help in the chat, and otherwise, here we go. Wait. Sorry about that. Something you just decided to quit on me. Here we go. Try again.
Okay, on the podcast and at the conference today, we have Joseph Goldstein. So Joseph is one of the sort of founding fathers of American Dharma practice, of American Vipassana. He's a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, along with Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg, who are also at the conference, author of numerous books, and frankly, a bit of a legend. So Joseph, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
You're just saying you're at the IMS today in the States, and it's kind of quiet right now.
Yeah, because of the pandemic, we're closed for in-house retreats, but we are doing a lot of online programming.
And, right, brave.
It's filling the gap a bit.
And yeah. Let's start at the beginning then. I know your story is kind of interesting. So how did you get interested in meditation, first of all? What was the route in for you?
Well, after college, I studied philosophy at college, and then I graduated and went into the American Peace Corps, and they sent me to Thailand. And when I was in Thailand, I started getting interested in Buddhism. There were a couple of monks, actually one Indian monk, one British monk, who were leading discussion groups for Westerners at a famous temple in Bangkok, the Marble Temple. So I went, I studied philosophy in college, and so I had a lot of interest. But I was also, I was young, I was 21 years old. I started going to these groups, and I was asking so many questions, you know, particularly because of my background in philosophy. People stopped coming to the group because I was going.
Okay, you know,
I'm sure we've all been in groups like that with people like that. So finally, one of the monks, I think maybe out of a little desperation, said, Joseph, why don't you try meditating? And of course, I knew nothing about it. It's, you know, my first time in Asia, as I say, young, it's kind of exotic. So I thought, sure, I'll give it a try. And I got my paraphernalia together. He gave me the basic instructions. And I set my alarm clock for 5 minutes because I didn't want to sit too much.
Yeah,
you start someplace. But it was interesting. Something really quite transformative happened in that first 5 minutes. And it wasn't any big enlightenment experience, but what I saw was that there was a way or methodology for looking into the mind as well as looking out through it. And that was just revelatory to me, you know, that there was actually a clear path to investigate and explore one's own mind. I got so excited by this. I started inviting my Peace Corps friends over to watch me meditate.
I love it. I love it.
Of course, they didn't come back too often, but that's how enthusiastic I was. You know, and then that was really the beginning.
It is a revelation, isn't it, that there's an inner world and we can study it or develop it systematically. That's a huge
thing. Yeah, exactly.
So not how we're educated, that it's like, I had this experience as well. I'm like, wow, there's a whole set of technologies that exist that have a whole history. And whew, all of a sudden there's this whole buffet of feast that's opened up that you didn't even know existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you studied different techniques. I know that you kind of studied Vipassana or different kind of Theravada and style Buddhist techniques primarily, right? So within...
Yeah. So after the Peace Corps, I came back to the States and I tried to continue my meditation by myself, but I found I really didn't quite know what I was doing. You know, so I was just mixing up a lot of different things, you know, third eye and mantras and the breath. And so after a while, I realized I needed a teacher. And so that's when I decided to go back to Asia, ended up in India. And finally, after traveling around a bit, met my first teacher in Bodh Gaya, which of course is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. And my teacher, my first teacher, Anagarika Munindra, he said something when I first met him that was so straightforward and so common sense, full of common sense, it really hooked me. He said, if you want to understand the mind, sit down and observe it. And that was it. There was nothing to join. There were no rituals. There were no ceremonies. There was no big hoopla. It was that simple. You know, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. And that really is what Vipassana practice is about. And so I was very engaged in Vipassana for many, many years, first in India, then in Burma. And then after many years, after maybe 30 years, 35 years of practice, I also began to study a little bit with some Tibetan masters. And that was a nice kind of addition or just adding some other perspectives to Vipassana. But nothing in conflict. It was really just part of the further exploration of Dharma.
So Joseph, you said something I think is very relevant for people today. Like, you know, I found a teacher and, you know, you had to go to India and kind of travel around. And I know you sort of tried a few different teachers and went to a Sikh temple and, you know, And it's like, now we can just turn on our computers, right? Like people at this conference, there's 1,000 teachers, right? Yeah. And we've got kind of a clever system that helps them sort through a little bit and find something that's more suitable. And but it's still a lot. And this is really the situation of the whole modern world now, that there's all these different teachers and, you know, styles, and you don't have to go to Tibet to study Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, in Moscow, there's a center just around the corner from where I am, and this is Moscow, you know? And then Zen and, you know, all the other things. So how does one select, so it isn't just like you were originally just throwing random techniques together, mantra this, that, like that. It would be very easy to do that in the modern world, to just throw stuff together without the guidance of a school or a teacher. So, yeah. So what do you think that is today?
So I would say kind of as one's first beginning that exploration, you know, of what practice might be appropriate for oneself or what teacher to connect with. So in that beginning exploratory process, I think it's good to just sample a wide range. And now with so much online, it's pretty easy to do, you know, whether it's listening to Dharma talks, listening to teachings, and getting a sense of both what practice resonates and then also what teacher resonates, you know, because, you know, all teachers have different styles, personalities, some we feel resonance with and others we don't. And so to do a little exploratory, one might call it shopping around, you know, and really seeing what connects. And then if we find one or you know, several teachers that we really resonate with, then to connect with what they're offering in terms of teaching, whether these days it's online or hopefully soon it'll be in-person retreats. Yeah, so I think it's really finding the person and the technique that really speaks to us in some way.
And I have this distinction there between the person and the technique, isn't it? Sometimes it's like, you know, I noticed you know, touched your heart there when you said that sometimes there is just a resonance, isn't there, in the body.
Yes.
And I've had stages where I've gone, you know what, I can't handle any more American teachers, or I really want a woman as a teacher, or there's some desire. I go, why do I want to? I don't know why, but I just want a female teacher or a British teacher, or, you know, and there's a resonance. And you almost described two stages, and I think you can make a mistake at either stage, right? So the first mistake is to not sample, which is now more possible than ever before. Like, yeah. Why not? Like, the conference is a great chance for anyone to sample. But also, the other mistake is to not commit, right? To not say, you know,
exactly.
What? I'm going to study Tibetan Buddhism, or I'm going to study with this Lama or this Zen teacher. I'm going to, you know, at least for a few years, I'm going to go for it and I'm going to kind of commit to that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are actually three stages. I think there's the shopping around to see, mm-hmm. okay, what connects with us. And then just as you say, it's really important then to commit for a significant period of time so we get some depth in that practice. Because if we keep just jumping around from one thing to another, we're not going to really find the depth. But at a certain point, you know, once we've matured in our practice to some extent, okay. and we have a pretty clear understanding, you know, both of the technique, the method, and the unfolding path of experience, at a certain point, you know, and this could be after years of practice, mm-hmm. then I think it can be valuable, if one has the interest, to then start exploring again, perhaps different methods or different teachers, because the Dharma is vast. You know, there's just so many perspectives and angles, you know, on the practice.
Joseph, I was struck, like, just jump in if I may, I hope you don't mind me interrupting occasionally, that like just your body work is huge. Like I was researching this before interviewing, I thought, okay, this is a good opportunity to listen to some more of Joseph's stuff. And I was like, wow, there's 100-200 podcasts. And then I, you know, Dharma Seed, there's a bunch more stuff, and then there's the books, okay, audiobooks, okay. And I'm like, wow. And then that's just one corner of Buddhism, which isn't even the only meditation tradition, right? Yeah. So it's pretty daunting, and it would be easy to become kind of consumerist about that, or trying to achieve something through that. That's stages I've noticed myself go through with, I've got to consume all of this teacher's work, or I've got to achieve a certain
amount. Well, I think this really points to an important progression where we go from the study of the teachings, you know, and reading and listening to the podcasts and the talks or whatever, you know, calls us. But then it's really important to take the next step into practice, where we're no longer just staying on the conceptual level, which is interesting and can be very illuminating, but it's obviously limited because it is still on the conceptual level. And so, you know, at a certain point, we really need to let the study part go into the background a bit and actually devote ourselves to the practice, so we're tasting it firsthand. It's no longer somebody else's experience, it becomes our own. And that's where the real transformation takes place.
It's a real difference. I was doing in a Russian martial arts dojo this morning, something called Sistema, which is a Russian martial art. And the guy was explaining something very similar. The teacher, Vladimir, he said that, you know, he's talking about the punch. And then he said, but you really need to experience it. And he does just this little tap on the shoulder, and I go flying across the room, and hit me with this. And I was like, whoa, that's a whole different experience than talking about being punched. You know, that's
exactly.
It was a very friendly, caring punch. It was nothing damaging.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was a whole different experience to experience it.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's just important to add here, it's in terms of people, you know, beginning to explore their interest in the possibility of meditation and going inward, and then reading and studying, and then actually committing to the practice, you know, in a real way.
Right.
What's important to understand is that the path of practice has lots of ups and downs. So it's not like an upward trajectory of more light and bliss and joy only.
Right.
You know, certainly those states can be part of the path, but it's much more than that. And people will experience times of real encouragement and times of discouragement. And that's part of the path. Yeah. That's part of the path. And that's why a teacher can be really helpful, because particularly, well, in both cases, so that we don't get attached, you know, to the happy states, and we know how to persevere in a steady way through the difficult times.
Right. It makes sense to me. I mean, I guess this is the embodiment conference, Joseph. We should talk about the body. So, you know, Vipassana, famous for its breath work and body scanning techniques. If somebody was sort of fairly new to Dharma or meditation Buddhism, and they sort of said, well, what's the role of the body? And maybe we could answer this question at beginners, intermediate, and advanced level. So like if a complete beginner said to you, why is the body matter for meditation? What might be your answer to that?
Well, in a way, it's very simple. It's always present and it's very tangible. You know, so it's not a difficult object of meditation to find, you know, whether it's the breath or the whole body, you know, scanning or working with the whole body in some way. It's very obvious. Not that it's easy to stay steady on it. That's challenging. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the object of our attention, it's not difficult to find, you know, and so. Yeah, and I think it's one of the reasons the Buddha started teaching really with mindfulness of the body.
Right, right. I mean, so much meditation is mindfulness of the breath, which is body.
Yeah,
you know, the body scanning. These are classic techniques, right? Metta, as it's taught by many people, involves the body as well as phrases. Yeah. So I guess it's right there. It's it's familiar in a way. And then what might be a slightly more advanced answer to that? Someone's been meditating a while and they say, hey, what is the body, Joseph? What's going on here? What might be another answer?
Okay, so this is a little technique which I've been using really just in the past few years because it came to me while I was on retreat myself. It was just a slightly different application of how to practice mindfulness of the body. So part of this practice is mindful of the body in movement, you know, and so we did in the Buddhist tradition, mostly we do it through walking meditation. Mm-hmm. And that can be done in many, many ways, you know, very slow walking or normal walking or fast walking. So that can vary according to the particular practice. What I started doing, there's a line in one of the Buddhist discourses. It's the foundational discourse on mindfulness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Yeah. And the first of those foundations is mindfulness of the body. And there's one line in the discourse, which I had read it many times, but it's only recently that I started actually putting it into practice. There's a line, be mindful, and then in the equivalent of quotes, there is a body. So be mindful, quote, there is a body. To the extent necessary for clear knowing and continuous mindfulness. So when I read that phrase, there is a body, because it's in quotes, it signified something equivalent to using it as a reminder or something like a mental note in the mind that we could repeat, oh, there is a body. There is a body. You know, so it suggests, or it's a coaching for us to settle into the awareness of the body. So here's where it got interesting. I started using that phrase as I was walking. You know, there is a body. So instead of a narrow focus, like on my feet or my legs in the movement, it became a bigger field, you know, just that whole frame, there is a body. And then as I was walking within that frame, there is a body, the experience is then, the experience of the body then becomes It's only sensations in space. That's the actual felt experience of the body in movement. You know, we tend through our sight to give it a form and a shape.
Right, right.
But when we're just in the awareness of the actual sensations of the body, the form disappears, the solidity disappears. Mm-hmm. And so even in saying there is a body, in that realization, we realize there is no body. Right. As something solid, something fixed, something unchanging. Well, that becomes a very deep insight, which leads to maybe the third stage, you know, as people progress in their practice of, and this is challenging, this is really challenging, of learning not to be identified with the body as being self, as being I. But of course, this identification with the body is very deeply conditioned. You know, if somebody, you know, comes up to him and says, "Who are you?" Oh, yeah, this is me. And we point to our bodies.
Yeah.
That habit is very strong. But the practice begins to weaken that identification. And there's a whole space of freedom, which then begins to open up.
And there is a difference, isn't there? Sometimes I catch myself when I'm doing a body scan where I go, "I'm not, that's my arm." And I'm like, no. Arm is an idea. And then you visualize my arm, but then actually it's just a bunch of flowing sensations in the area where I suppose my arm to be.
Exactly. Oh, you're in the advanced stage.
You have inspired me to practice again lately, though, I tell you. It's very inconvenient, Joseph, to put in the practice. But so the other piece you said there about identification and disidentification with the body. So in a way, embodiment, we could say, is identification with the body. It's saying, you know, I am a body, or this body is part of my being, part of myself. It's not just, it's not a brain taxi. And there's something like, maybe you could help me articulate this more intelligently, but if people try and do that too soon, or there's maybe a near enemy, to use a Buddhist phrase, where they're saying, well, I'm not my body, and it's just a sort of almost trauma dissociation rather than true, they're not identified enough to disidentify.
Right.
Maybe you can help me out here, what I'm getting at.
I think that latter point you made, kind of the caution or the danger of speaking about not being identified with the body, if that's misunderstood, then that could lead to people not actually feeling the body.
Yeah.
So to not be identified with the body doesn't mean not feeling it. And it actually allows us to drop into the exploration in a profound way of what is it that we're calling the body? You know, so this brings us to another whole level, like we were just saying, instead of limiting our sense of the body to the form, you know, or what it looks like. When we say, okay, well, what is it that I'm actually calling the body? That's when we drop in, we could say, I'll use this phrase, to the energetic flow of what the body is. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not at all a distancing from that. It's just not claiming that, you know, as self or I. It's a much freer space.
Right.
But it's an embodied space. You know, it's not disembodied at all. It's dropping from the concept of the body to the felt experience of it. Mm-hmm. Not unlike, you know, I've done a little bit of yoga, a little bit of Tai Chi. It's very much like that. You know, when we're dropping into the body and feeling the energy, the many energies, you know, that are flowing.
You were talking about, I think, the Satipatthana Sutta earlier, right? Was that the...
Yeah.
So I just brought it up on the computer because wonderful internet, gotta love it. There's some great translations. It's things like experience the whole body in brackets, breath, body. And there's another piece here, which is similar, I think, to what you were saying earlier. Thus, he lives contemplating the body in the body internally, or he lives contemplating the body in the body externally. Or lives, so it's this, the somatic, the subjective sense of the body is very much pointed to in this foundational Buddhist text, right? And this is like the mindfulness text, right?
Yeah. And in that same discourse, it also, there's a whole section of being mindful of the body in just the ordinary daily activities of moving forward, moving backward, dressing, eating, just everything we do during the day, we are embodied. So the question is, are we being mindful of that? Are we being aware of that experience, not the idea or the image, you know, or not? And of course, the practice strengthens our ability to be embodied. And then there's a further insight that comes from all this.
I want to get into the deeper insights as well, because I think this is, often in mindfulness, it's like, okay, try and pay attention. Concentration's good for you. It's relaxing. And I'm like, oh, guys, you're missing the point. You're looking at the Mona Lisa and thinking it's just a picture of some chick. You know, come on, what are you doing? So it's like, maybe you could speak a little bit to the sort of the insights of impermanence and dukkha.
Exactly.
No self. I'd love to hear you speak about that, particularly in relation to the body.
Well, one of the obvious things that becomes very apparent quite quickly is that, again, in our experience of the body and the sensations, the felt sense of it, we see and experience that these sensations are continually changing. There is nothing static. There is nothing fixed at all. And so we begin to experience the impermanence, and the more clearly we see that, the less we become attached to things staying a certain way, you know, because we're experiencing the moment-to-moment change and flux. And a word came to mind which surprised me, even as it came to mind, the creativity of it, creativity of the energetic process, you know, that's in continual movement. So as we experience that, the mind lets go of grasping or holding on or being attached to the body staying a certain way, which of course it never will. And this leads to really a very simple but profound truth, that if we're attached to that which in its very nature changes, we'll suffer. So if we're attached to youth, we're going to suffer as we get old. You know, if we're attached to health, we're going to suffer when we get sick. And again, this is not to say that we don't take care of the body and, you know, practice good health protocols, but it's inevitable. And the Buddha pointed this out.
It's going to happen. Joseph, can I link this to some other embodied practices? Because people, like the youth one, for example, right? Like, I'm 41. I started embodied practice when I was 18. You know, for a while I was a young badass martial artist, pretty athletic. You know, now I go to a martial arts class and I feel kind of like, oh, creaky and a bit flat. But that's really, it's humbling. And simultaneously, that is my practice to go, you know what, I'm 41 now. And I'm looking after myself. I'm probably healthier than, I'm healthier than all my school friends who are 41, you know, but it's, you know, we have different lifestyles, but that's the practice of going, wow, I am impermanent. And you know what? I'm not quite as flexible as last year. And maybe I could really practice. And I could really do that stretch in yoga. And maybe I get more flexible. That is possible as you age. But then there is also this, you know, things are falling apart. And as you say, the other thing with the body that makes it such a great anchor is that it's not an anchor, is that it's always changing. Like the breath has got so much going on with
it.
That it's much more teaching me this lesson of change than just staring at a wall. I mean, a wall is also falling apart, but it's not so obvious that the wall is vibrating at a molecular level. Whereas my own body, it's pretty obvious that it's, you know, I had a sauna yesterday here in Russia and we went into the cold water after the hot, and my skin was just tingling afterwards, like these magical little light butterflies all over it. And what a great object for meditation that is.
Yes, and that points to another, I would say, profound and liberating insight. And it was highlighted in one teaching of the Buddha, which this is a very high bar that I'm about to say. But we can practice it at whatever level we're at. And so the one point the Buddha said, as long as there's attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is impossible. So this is really quite startling, because we're so deeply conditioned to go after the pleasant and to avoid the unpleasant. This just seems natural and normal, and why not? But the Buddha was making a very different point, that the pleasant and unpleasant experiences in our lives also are impermanent. They're not, neither one is going to last. And the freedom of mind is in that equanimity, which can be with the pleasant fully without the clinging, and to be with the unpleasant. And as you say, with these aging bodies, this is going to happen. It happens all the time. I mean, can we learn to be with the unpleasant without the aversion?
Yeah. I keep jumping in. I'm just getting excited. I've been made by this a lot. There's a terrible interview. But there's, for example, it strikes me that somatic practice is a wonderful place to practice this Buddhist realization. For example, in yoga, the average yoga class, there will be some deeply physically unpleasant experiences. Your hamstrings will hurt.
Yes.
You know, it will be, you know, if there's any, like, you know, I got punched today, you know, maybe you're dancing, and, you know, dancing's really hardcore. You know, dancers really suffer. They're the tough ones. And then we also have pleasant experiences. So when we're dancing, we have these states that are like, oh my God, I'm, you know, in bliss. It's like, it won't last. Or I'm doing martial arts. I'm like, yeah, I'm powerful. I feel good. It won't last. And then there's, you know, yoga. It's like I'm this endorphin sort of slight, you know, as an ex-drug addict, these sort of opiate highs you get from yoga. That will wear off. Don't worry. So it just strikes me that, like, these somatic practices, you just have these lots of opportunity to play with this non-attachment, right?
Oh, absolutely. And so I just want to go back to another teaching of the Buddha's, which points to the universality of the experiences we're talking about, even though we often don't like to acknowledge it. So just as an example, when the Buddha was talking, basically it was recollections or meditations on the body from a particular slant. So he said that what has the nature to age will age, and I am not exempt. What has the nature to grow ill will grow ill, and I am not exempt. What has the nature to die will die, and I am not exempt. Well, I think we all can resonate pretty easily with, there's aging and illness and death. But what I found very interesting in my own experience is that even though I knew this, you know, intellectually and conceptually, but deep down I felt that either I was exempt or I should be exempt.
I know you guys are gonna get ill and die.
I'm like,
I always have that, it's very Irish actually. It's like, I'm special and different, right? Like, oh yeah, the red traffic light's for you. I get it, but it's not really for me. But it's like, what is that gap? So I know intellectually everything changes, that's an easy one. Suffering is there, you know, okay, a little bit trickier to admit, but yeah, it's just kind of obvious that stuff makes you suffer when it's, you know, nice stuff is removed, or, you know, nasty stuff is put in front of me. But it, you know, I'm gonna die. Okay, I see that everywhere, right? Like, I'm gonna get ill. You know, COVID is really kind of confronting people with that right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to get old. Of course I'm going to get old. Like, literally my teeth are, you know, I've got British teeth falling out now. It's like, oh, every day I brush my teeth and go, there's holes in those teeth. You've got better teeth. But it's like, yeah, that's still intellectual. What stops us from rocking it emotionally and sort of cutting the crap, if you'll excuse the phrase, and kind of going, you know what, I'm kidding myself. Of course this applies to me. Yeah. Why that gap?
I think it's the gap between when we're living our lives, one might say in our heads, you know, in the conceptual realm, and when through whatever particular methodology or practice we become embodied, that we're actually feeling the body from the inside and paying attention, you know, in a careful way, then there's no denying the aging and the effects of aging,
right?
You know, and So just an example, a little practice I do. I'm old, as you say. I'm also, for the most part, pretty healthy. But like everybody, from time to time, I get sick, you know, with something. But I really try to use times of sickness as a meditation. And I frame it in terms of, oh, this is good practice for dying. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we don't know what the circumstances will be of our death, but it's fairly likely that the body is going to be in some level of discomfort, you know, either major or less. But so the question is, have we trained ourselves to be with that in a really peaceful, open way or not? You know, when we get to that point, will it freak us out? You know, as the body begins to age and grow ill and die. So I see this, whatever embodied practice we're doing, to actually include in that times when it is painful or times when we are ill, because that's really the time to explore the possibility of freedom, even in that circumstance. So the body is just providing us opportunities, really opportunities for liberation, you know, throughout our lives. But we have to be mindful. You know, if we're not mindful, then we're not going to learn from it.
Yeah, I had that. I think I'm pretty sure I had the old coronavirus a few months back, and I had very shortness of breath, and I said goodbye to my wife at a distance because I had to chuck her out of the house because I was coming back from a trip. I said, "You need to go, get out of the house." And I waved to her across the street. I didn't want to hug her, and I was in the house, and my breath was really tight, and I thought, "Wow, what if this is it?" You know, what if and I just phoned up the NHS, and they were like, "Oh, we're busy, we can't send them." Okay, this isn't good.
Oh, dying, never mind.
I'm like, all right, okay, oh, this is it. But it's a hell of a meditation, and you know, those death meditations, which I've done in Theravada Buddhism, and you know, I've done by working in war zones and other places, the sort of, you know, accidental death meditation like that, they're actually wonderful in what they bring. Now, I don't recommend it to everyone at all times, right? But the gratitude that can come, the aliveness, the insight, the fuel for practicing that can come from those the contemplation of death, the closeness to realizing one's body is falling apart, and old age and disease are coming for all of us.
And the peace that can come from that kind of understanding.
Right.
You know, so it is challenging, but as we practice with it, we actually come to a place of acceptance and of ease. You know, oh, this is just nature. This is the nature of things. It's not a mistake.
Right. What me? Who me? But it also definitely takes the edge off stress, doesn't it? You know, I mean, some financial thing, and one of my teachers said, "Don't worry, it will all be over soon." Both just laughed. It just seemed ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
It seemed ridiculous. Okay, so change, we can feel that in the body. It's pretty obvious. We're falling apart. Dukkha, you know, suffering, it's there. Things are unsatisfactory. You know, sit in any yoga position for more than 5 minutes and that one becomes obvious. No self. That's a little trickier. I've heard you speak very beautifully around this. Could you speak a little bit to that? Because I feel like it's like people that are getting into modern mindfulness, they're sometimes missing the really good stuff or the deeper kind of things.
Yeah.
So a bit about that.
Well, that is a hard one to understand even conceptually, because unlike impermanence and, you know, the suffering or unreliable aspect of changing experience, it's not hard to grasp even intellectually. You know, we can understand it even if we haven't plumbed the depths of it. But selflessness or no self is that one part of the Buddhist teaching which doesn't lend itself to a common sense view of it. Mm-hmm. It's counterintuitive. You know, our whole life has been centered around the self, you know, which right in that expression, I think it points to something interesting, whether we acknowledge it or not, most of us are self-centered, which doesn't mean necessarily being selfish, but our lives revolve around this notion of self and I. And so the Buddha was just pointing out that the self, the I, is a concept. In kind of the same way that the form of the body is a concept, just like we were saying, when we actually drop in to the felt experience of the body, we see there's nothing solid there at all.
Right. This one's kind of intuitive, isn't it? It's like every time I come across it, I'm like, no, that's not right. And then I examine the heaps, you know, and okay, well, there's thoughts and there's body, but what am I? You know, actually.
Well, yeah. And so that's really a doorway into beginning to understand the selfless nature of the body. But it doesn't mean that the body disappears. It's just that we're going from the conceptual level to the felt experience of its changing nature. So I'll just give an example. Maybe this will help elucidate it. You know, after a summer storm, you know, sometimes there's a beautiful rainbow in the sky. And generally people, you know, see a rainbow and it's beautiful. You know, we feel a certain joy or delight just in seeing, oh, look at the rainbow. So then, but a further investigation might be after the enjoyment of it, you know, so we don't want to take that part away. But after the enjoyment of it, we might want to investigate, well, what actually is a rainbow? Is a rainbow a thing in and of itself? And then we see, no, a rainbow is an appearance when certain conditions come together, like moisture and air and sun, you know, so these conditions come together and there's an appearance of a rainbow. But the rainbow is not anything in itself. It's just a designation for the appearance of those conditions, you know, coming together. Well, self is like rainbow. You know, it's a designation and a useful one. To understand selflessness doesn't mean that we get rid of the vocabulary of self, because this is just conventional language and how we speak, I and you and self and other, all that's fine. But when we look deeper, we see that it is just a designation for a pattern of changing elements, you know? And when we see it on that level, then we're no longer identified or attached to the concept or to the appearance. So again, you know, when we see a rainbow, it's not knowing that the rainbow is not some substantial thing existing in and of itself. So we can really know that, but still appreciate and love seeing the rainbow.
Right.
So it doesn't get rid of that part of it.
Like rainbows, most people find are beautiful. They're fabulous. Let's face it, darling. You know, like everybody loves a rainbow. And it's like a lot of examples I hear around the self. It's almost like you should get rid of yourself. Like almost self-hatred can sneak in, can't it, if we're not careful? So I love the rainbow analogy because it's
kind of, well, and there's one more key point here. There's nothing to get rid of because the self as a substantial entity is not there in the first place. So it's like, in order to see the component elements of the rainbow, we don't have to get rid of the rainbow. The appearance of it will be there, you know? And nothing changes. Nothing changes in the sky. It's still there and it's beautiful and we respond, but we see it on a deeper level. We're not reifying it through the concept. And so that's the same thing with self, taking this mind-body process to be self, you know. We experience the changing elements of the mind and body without reifying the concept. And that's very freeing, you know, because then we're living in a really creative, dynamic way. And again, using the sense of self conventionally, there's no problem with that at all, you know?
Yeah.
But we don't want to get attached or stuck with the concept.
Yeah, I don't have to say the entity known as Mark agrees with you, Joseph. It's not necessary to start getting weird about it or self-hating himself or anything like that. Yeah. Okay. You know what? I kind of feel like I want to give a little nudge, a little challenge to some of my embodiment friends listening to this who maybe don't do sitting meditation or, you know, kind of formal practice. They say, hey, yoga's my meditation or dance is my meditation. And I said, yeah, but maybe you're missing something here. Like, what, you know, obviously different things for different people, and hey, anything positive is all good. You know, this is the embodiment conference. We love it all. But is there a reason to do this kind of like sitting meditation where one's really looking at one's mind rather than just doing yoga or just doing dance, for example? Do you see a reason to sit as well?
Well, so as we said earlier on, mindfulness of the body is the first of the foundations mm-hmm. of mindfulness. But mindfulness practice and Vipassana includes more than the body. It's definitely the place to start and a powerful, and the Buddha said mindfulness of the body leads to enlightenment. So it's really powerful. But there's much more to us than the body, you know, because in Vipassana and mindfulness practice, we want to become aware of thoughts and we want to become aware of emotions and aware of our activities, aware of our speech, you know, so all of that is included. And in sitting, particularly with respect to becoming mindful of greater subtleties in the mind, because the body is still. So at that time, it's easy to go from the awareness of the body in sitting position, because we're not moving, then it's easier to become really mindful as thoughts appear in the mind or images appear in the mind and directing our attention to them. So we're not just letting them pass through and ignoring them. They actually become the object of our awareness. Mm-hmm. So the practice really becomes an exploration of our hearts and minds, as well as an exploration of the body. And this is in a very explicit way. And the importance of this, I'll just share one little suggestion, perhaps, for people to explore, particularly in these times. One of the things that we begin to learn through this observation of the mind is how powerfully thoughts condition emotions. You know, we can have a thought about a person or about a situation, either pleasant or unpleasant, and that thought very often in a moment can trigger either a loving feeling or fear or anxiety or worry. And as I said, particularly in these times, those emotions are coming up a lot for people. What happens is, when we're not being mindful of how it's happening, we are reinforcing these difficult emotions throughout the day by not being mindful of all the many, many, even quickly passing thoughts that are going through. And so they are conditioning our inner environment, the thoughts conditioning emotions, and before we know it, we're living in that world. So I had an interesting example of how this works. Just the other night, I was watching a movie on TV, and I became vividly aware of how the background music of the movie was manipulating my emotions, mm-hmm. much more than what I was seeing. You know, so I like to watch murder mysteries.
Okay, so
cool. That's my thing.
Buddhism is a murder mystery, essentially, isn't it? It's like you're gonna die. Who did it? You know what I mean? Like that's there's a great analogy in there somewhere.
Exactly. But what was so interesting was, until I had really highlighted the effect of the background music, I was not aware that that's what was creating all these emotional responses and, you know, a little, you know, anxiety or worry about what was going to happen to the character or whatever. But this is what's happening to all of us throughout the day. The thoughts that are running through our mind are like the background music that we're not paying much attention to, mm-hmm. but are having a profound effect.
Yes, yes.
And so mindfulness of thought in the mind is hugely helpful. To rest in a place of ease, so we're not being manipulated emotionally
yes.
by the thoughts that are going through our minds.
For me, there's an argument for subtlety for sitting. Like, I love to dance, I love to do martial arts, I love to do yoga, I do all, but like, I love to go on retreat once or twice a year. These days, often a silent retreat, a solitary retreat. because it's like when I quieten down and I stop moving, so my body's quieter, you know, moving less, then I just notice a level of subtlety that I'm not normally aware of, but that is impacting me. Yeah. And that could be my mind, or it could be subtler sensations with the body. And as you say, it's very easy for a thought to just start running the show. Like I spoke to a student today, who had a baby 5 weeks ago, and I was sort of having a support call, you know, seeing how she's doing. And she somehow, as we were talking, just very quickly said, oh, I'm a milking machine or something. And it, she'd got it into her head at some point that she was a machine that had to sort of be suckled upon. And it just clear to me that this thought was not helping. I said, "Is this? Hey, did you catch that?" And she sort of had, and she went, "Oh yeah, I'm not a machine. My baby's not parasitizing on me." Yeah. You know, she just had this whole, and it was in the background the last 5 weeks. It had been running the show, and I think, you know, adding to her stress and exhaustion and this kind of thing. And she just caught it and was like, "Oh, yeah. You know, I don't want to have that thought about myself." You know.
Yeah, that's a beautiful example. You know, of just how our thoughts, unbeknownst to us, can be conditioning our whole inner world.
Yeah, I just caught the word as she was speaking. Said, And then she went back to it and went, "Oh, that's how I've been conditioning myself for the last 5 weeks."
Right, but I think it's helpful to realize that that's a very striking example. But even just ordinary thoughts that are passing through, you know, about the world and about politics and about the pandemic and whatever. You know, just the ordinary parade of thoughts in our minds, each one of them is conditioning an inner state.
Right, right, right.
And it conditions it more powerfully when we're not mindful of it.
Right.
And
people were saying around the conference, people were saying, the staff were saying, this is crazy. And I sort of said, let's stop saying it's crazy. It's not crazy. It's a challenge.
Yes.
It's you know, potentially stressful. It's not easy, but it's not insane. Like what we're doing is not crazy. It's a very sane thing. It's just a challenge. So let's be clear about that. Yeah. So this catching can be very, very helpful. Okay, Joseph, I mean, we could talk about a million more things. We need to wrap up relatively soon, just for the sort of time frame of the conference. We like to have what's called a coffee break afterwards. So after we play, this will be recorded, often they're live, and then people have this coffee break where they can go and discuss the session with, you know, other people. Right. And always encourage people to do that. Before we go, I mean, you know, do you want to leave people with anything for their coffee break, for them to think about or talk about with each other?
Yeah, so just one last little... teaching, which I have found really interesting, just to share with people, and then they can, you know, explore it if it resonates at all. And this has to do with what we were just talking about in terms of mindfulness of thought. You know, so thoughts are going through our minds all day long. You know, we may think we're in silence, but our minds are not, for the most part, are not silent. It's just this steady stream of thoughts. So then it gets very interesting to become mindful of the thinking process. The beginning level of that is at least to recognize what the patterns of thought are. Is it planning? Is it desire? Is it, you know, aversion to something? Is it judgment? Is it whatever? Just the ordinary categorization of thoughts, because it helps give us a little more clarity and distance. But more interesting than that, in terms of exploring thought, is to, when the mind is thinking a lot, to actually ask the question, what is a thought? Not what is the thought saying, but what is the thought as a phenomenon?
Wow.
And this is incredibly interesting, because when we really look as a thought is happening and we're holding that inquiry in our mind, well, what is it? Not the content. Just what is it as a phenomena? We see that it's little more than nothing. It's just this little kind of poof of mental energy. And yet, when we're unaware of thought, when we're not mindful, they have tremendous power in our lives. It's like thoughts are the little dictators of the mind. Mm-hmm. Go here, go there, do this, do that. You know, get married, get divorced, whatever. And this disjunct between the power thoughts have in our lives when we're not mindful of them, and seeing their essentially empty nature when we are mindful, that is revelatory. You know, we no longer have to to suffer at the whims of our thoughts when we are really looking. But what is a thought? Little more than nothing. Yeah. So that's tremendously liberating and would be interesting perhaps for people to explore.
Wonderful. Okay. That gives people something to talk about in the Facebook group or their coffee breaks. And I do recommend all the different stuff Joseph's got on the internet. I was really enjoying the ones with him and Sam Harris. Sam's such a great interviewer and really puts it together beautifully. And, you know, you've got your own podcast that's got like at least 100 episodes on. So I'm going to be working my way through them, no doubt, in the bath. Normally I listen to Buddhist talks in the bath. I find that's a good time for it. So where else can people find you online, Joseph? What should people be looking for, like with IMS and this kind of thing?
Yeah, so the website is www.dharma.org, dharma.org. And that's the website of our center. There's lots of resources and books and right. Just everything's on there.
Any books you recommend for sort of embodiment people, particularly that might be sort of good books for people who are embodiment people who want to, you know, not taste this, but read about it until they're ready to be punched by the Dharma?
Yeah. Well, maybe a good book. It's actually my first book that was just reissued. So this, The Experience of Insight. Okay. And it's basically a book of a 30-day meditation retreat broken down into daily instructions and talks and Q&A. And so there's a lot in there and a lot in there about the body, but also it's kind of a general survey of the Buddhist teachings with lots of stories from other traditions. So that could be a good entree for people.
Great, great. And I see there's audio books on Audible for people that maybe you can't see so easily or whatever. So I'm a big fan of the audio books these days. Okay, so Joseph, just to finish up, closing message about the body, anything at all. We'll put it in our little book we're putting together at the end. Closing message about the body from you, sir.
Right. Take care of it and don't identify with it because it's following its own laws, its own nature.
Beautiful. This has been an honor, a pleasure. It's been fun. I really enjoyed it, Joseph. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
G'day everyone. Wasn't that a wonderful presentation? I highly enjoyed it. I deliberately didn't watch it beforehand because I wanted to enjoy it here live. So Joseph is an absolute legend in the field of meditation. And in terms of stuff coming up, actually, talking about legends, Tara Brach is actually up in 1 hour on the keynote stage as well. So I'd highly recommend checking out Tara. Jack Kornfield's going to be on, Sharon Salzberg. I think her interview's at midday tomorrow, possibly. I talked about, talking to some of these guys, and Sharon I was in communication with, and she's wonderful as well. So they're all, I love how they embody their message. So they're definitely worth checking out. I've also posted the links there to the coffee break room and the Facebook group. If you miss those, I'll post them down there again. It's always nice to chat with some other people to help integrate in the coffee break rooms. Facebook has a ton of discussion going on as well. So it's well worth going over there to do that. In terms of other stuff, you saw that Joseph can be found at, on his website there. And founder of the Insight Meditation Society. So at dharma.org, dharma.org. And if you'd like to, this will be up for another, Christopher Titmus, he's 8 a.m. UK tomorrow morning, which makes it a little bit early for the US, but the replays are available for 48 hours for free. So if you miss anyone, you can catch them on replays. As well, if you would like to upgrade to the full package, there's different options for that as well. So you can get the whole meditation and breathwork channel along with the keynotes as one of the packages. You can get all 1,000 speakers if you want, stuff like, the trauma channel, the yoga channel, anything else like that. It's a real big help for us because it costs a lot to put on. But, if you want to check out or, help us out because you can afford it. It's the full library that you can have for the rest of your life and perhaps many more lives after that. So, and then in terms of meditation and breathwork channel, after Tara Brach, we've got another treat, which is Lawrence Galloway at 2 a.m. UK time, which makes it 9 p.m. in the Eastern States and 6 p.m. Pacific. He's going to be going into Samadhi. I did that He's a really knowledgeable dude as well. So I do highly recommend checking out Lawrence as the next person on the Meditation and Breathwork channel. And got to wrap up. So thank you everyone for this. And I hope you took away something useful, and we'll catch you in an hour with Tara Brach or 3 hours with Lawrence. So cheers all.